Morning, everyone. Welcome to the new term, the new Bina term. Just to remind everyone, just for try and remove any confusion. We're doing a one-off topic today. Next week, I will be away. Please God, I'm joining a group of rabbis on Sunday, going to Israel for a week, which will hopefully be beautiful and inspirational. I'll be away just for 1 week. And then the following week, which is the 15th of May, we're starting a new series. These called Great Viktor Frankl Nuggets. I think I mentioned to you before that I recently discovered like writings of his that they discovered a few years ago and YouTube interviews. There's a lot of good material there. And I think it'd be great to have a look at some of those ideas. I don't remember which date, but in this series, one of the weeks, we're actually going to have a guest speaker. I'll just give you a little bit of preview. I mean, just you'll see all the various advertising. But you remember last two terms, we did stuff on emotional well-being, and it was based on a book called Letters for Life, which was letters written by the Lubavitcher Rebbe on all different types of, it was different things that we did, different parts of emotional struggles and well-being and so on. And it was in a book that was put together really, really well by different anecdotes and so on. And the book is an excellent book. And the author is doing a book tour. So I'm going to do an interview with him one of the Thursday mornings. I thought since we did the book, it would be really nice to actually talk to him. He's a young guy and has done a lot of research in the Lubavitcher Rebbe's views on all these different emotional ideas. Which is very extensive, and I think it'll be very, very interesting. It's not in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, it's more like 4 weeks or 5 weeks, but it'll be nice. So watch out for the advertising on it, the posters and so on. And before we start, I just want to welcome Maureen, right? Who's here from South Africa visiting her family. We have a special connection, even though I don't know Maureen very well, she doesn't know me very well, but my parents lived in Cape Town in a place called Camps Bay, I think it was. And they live next door, so she remembers my mother very well, and my older brother, and so on. So welcome and enjoy your stay. Okay, so today's topic, a one-off topic, I said the evil eye. What is it, and what can we do about it, and what's the concept? So it's actually a very fascinating topic. And I'm going to talk about two ideas. First of all, I know it's not specifically a personal growth topic, but there's a lot of personal growth ideas and lessons that come from the topic, which I'm going to explore. I'm sure many of you know the expression in Yiddish that people always say, Kenan Hora, right? So we'll see what that means. Or the Sephardim have a different one. The Sephardim say, Ben Porat Yosef. And to look at the whole topic, where it comes from, what's the idea? Now, there's a little bit of controversy around the topic. Not much, only because in the Torah, in Jewish thinking, there's actually a prohibition to be superstitious, right? Going under a ladder is a problem, or I don't know, the 13th day of the month, or Friday the 13th, all that stuff is actually forbidden. According to Jewish thought, we don't believe in it, it doesn't mean anything, it's nonsense, and all days are good. So the question is, how does that work? And in fact, some of them in the Torah are actually under the category of idol worship, and then sometimes we, predicting that this day is a good day to do things, it's not a good day to do things. That's in the Torah, it's pretty clear that's all forbidden and all prohibited, and we don't believe in it, right? However, it is true, except when the Torah itself talks about things like that, right? So there are concepts in Judaism which are minor and major, which seem superstitious, and yet are real, because we believe they're real because they come from legitimate Torah sources, right? An example would be, not to do with evil eye, but the answer would be, there's certain things we are taught in halakha, like we don't do because they can cause you to forget. I think I've shared with you a custom that some people have. The Talmud has a funny thing, and I'm not going to go into now why it's like that, but that olives are not good for your memory. But olive oil is good for your memory. So some people have a custom. I do this, that when I open up a tin of olives, I pour a little bit of olive oil in and mix it up. So that balances it out, right? it's in the Talmud. Or not wearing clothing inside out, like to wear different things that there are legitimate sources that meaningless thing. And the evil eye is one of them. The evil eye does exist. Now, how it exists, how damage going to do. But there is a concept of ayin hara in Jewish sources. In fact, in the Pirkei Avot, in the Ethics of the Fathers, one of the sayings in Pirkei Avot is from Rabbi Yehoshua. Rabbi Yehoshua says that there are three things that can destroy the world or destroy a person from the world. And he says, ayin hara is one of them. The evil eye is one of them, right? He says, the evil eye, the yetzer hara, the evil inclination, and hatred between people. We know that's very destructive, right? And the Zohar talks about being very careful from ayin hara, as they call it in Yiddish or in Hebrew, the concept of evil eye. So, and we'll see that actually has certain ramifications in the way we do certain things and certain halachot and so on and so forth. So let's just explore what it is first of all before we talk how it works and how we can protect ourselves from it and so on. But you've got to wait till then, because really it's not a problem if we have the right frame of mind. Okay? But nevertheless, there are, we'll see. So the common theme about Ayin Hara basically is, right, the evil eye and the effect of the evil eye, is highlighting or publicizing something to the point where it causes others to be jealous or to look negatively on it. And the power of that person that might have, or the power of that thinking of jealousy of the others, to actually cause some spiritual or physical damage to the person that has publicized and highlighted the concept, causing jealousy from other people, right? Obviously connected to something in the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot, which is Lo Tachmod, one shouldn't covet, right? Jealousy is actually has its roots in the Ten Commandments. It's not a good thing, and so on. Now, how does it work? What does that mean? Like, I mean, surely if God doesn't think we're deserving of a problem, so why should someone else be able to cause that problem? So it's not clear exactly how it works, but it's got something to do with the following. That we have this balance between din, between justice. You know, sometimes God does bring justice on people. He does. I mean, it's not for us to understand or not for us to interpret anything as a punishment, but there is that concept in Jewish law. However, we also have the concept of God being compassionate and rachum. And, you know, when we apologize or we do tshuva, whatever, he overlooks our weaknesses, he overlooks our deficiencies, he overlooks the things that we've done wrong, maybe the gossip that we've spoken or the whatever spiritually we've done wrong. And he lets it lie. However, it's not healthy. What that means, and Hashem, we'll come to it later again in another context, but he lets it be. He doesn't highlight it. But when we have highlighted ourselves, kind of thing, and to the point where it's caused others to be jealous, not that we're responsible for their jealousy, but that's what it has, just the reality. It's caused their jealousy to happen, or it's caused, you know, them to look at us badly and to be very jealous and to talk about it, and so on and so forth. What it does, apparently spiritually, it creates a scrutiny on us, because now we are now highlighted, so to speak. And when a person is highlighted, I say, just tell us that we become more vulnerable to things that we've done perhaps that weren't okay, because none of us are perfect, but it highlights every part of us, and that becomes a kind of causes and ignites almost like God's scrutiny, and therefore that could affect us negatively, right? That's the basic idea. Which is why the Talmud tells us that Ein habracha shore ela al davar hasamui min ha'ayin. That blessing takes place when something is hidden from the eye. It's not good to publicize things. It doesn't bring blessing. It's better to keep things under wraps, so to speak, understated, right? Because that is a recipe for blessing. Where do we see this in Jewish history? Sometimes things have to happen, but it's not always so good when they're so highlighted. So, for example, even with God giving us the Torah, which is gonna, you know, which we celebrate now in a few weeks' time. So we have Pesach and then we have Shavuot. Now we're in the days of the Omer. Shavuot is the commemoration of the day God gave us the Torah on Mount Sinai. The Talmud tells us a fascinating thing. When God gave us the Torah on Mount Sinai, He gave us the Ten Commandments, right? And the whole Ten Commandments, the whole event, was amazingly public and spectacular. It was felt throughout the whole world, right? There was thunder, there was lightning, the mountain The mountain was smoking. God's voice was booming. The whole world went still. It was an incredible, dramatic event. Obviously by divine design, right? And it had to be that way. Because that was the foundation of Jewish identity, essentially. And yet, what happened to the Ten Commandments, the tablets? 40 days later, Moshe Rabbeinu comes down the mountain. The Jews were serving the golden calf, and boom, smashed. They didn't last. They were very holy. They were inscribed by God himself, and then last. So the whole story went up another 40 days, and then a third 40 days, and that was the 40 days between the beginning of Elul and Yom Kippur. We've talked about this before. And Moshe Rabbeinu brings down the mountain on Yom Kippur, when God forgave us for the golden calf. He brought down the second tablets, right? Luchot Shniot. And they're still around. We don't know exactly where, but they're still around. They're in the ark somewhere. The ark is eternal. It's hidden. We have a tradition. It's hidden somewhere deep, deep, deep down below the temple mount. But we don't know where. We don't know where it is. And it's still around. So the Talmud says that the first luchot, the first set of tablets that were given with such publicity and such fanfare and drama, didn't last. But the luchot shniyot, which was an understated event, Moshe Rabbeinu came down, there was no thunder, there was no lightning, there was no dramatic events, he gave the Jewish people the second commandments, it was put place in the ark, and boom, it's done, we finished. And it's still around. The Talmud tells us that to highlight that certain things are more eternal and last better when they understate. Now, another source where we find that the Ayin Hara is really a real thing, not only can someone be susceptible to Ayin Hara, but it's prohibited, it says in the Torah, in the Halakha, in Jewish law, it's prohibited to cause an evil eye. And this comes out in a statement of the Talmud. It says that a person is not allowed to stand next to the field of his friend. Field. Now, this is obviously in the context in the ancient times where Israel was a complete agricultural society and neighbors were actually neighbors of, it was like farmland, right? Roland knows what I'm talking about. So, right? So they're both growing wheat, they're growing barley, they're able to eat from it, they're able to sell it. And maybe the one's a better farmer than the other. I don't know. One is getting more blessing and the guy stands on the border of the field looking at his friend. He's looking, you know, how his crop is going. He says, oh, it's...
The rain and the other one doesn't get the rain.
Yeah, can it happen?
It does happen.
There you are, you see? So the one guy's looking at his friend's thing, he says, oh, I wonder what he did. I wonder why my field's not like that. You're not going to do that. Don't look at someone else's field. Why? Because we're physical people. We're not perfect. Putting yourself in a position where you are going to stand at someone's field, border, right? I don't know. You can translate whatever you want in today's... Don't look at someone's new car. I don't know, whatever the case is, right? But we might, you know, we can be jealous and we'll look at it negatively and we could cause them damage because of that, right? That's the idea of Ayin Hara. We can cause an Ayin Hara and that's not good, so we shouldn't be doing that. Privacy is an extremely respected thing in Jewish tradition, right? Okay. Now, interestingly enough, later on, I'll show you that really we shouldn't over-obsess about it. We shouldn't worry about it so much. But I'll explain to you why. But we do have practical laws and practical customs that people keep, which are all based on this idea not to create an Ayin Hara. For example, one of the mitzvot in the Torah is we don't count people. You know that? Right, we don't count people. You're not supposed to count the crowd. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? Even if you know, it's always a problem in shul because you want to check if there's a minion, right? So there's a way to do it. Like you don't count it with numbers. You count it with, there's a pasuk that we say, like a verse that's got 10 words. Oshia et amecha. So you look around the room, you say, Oshia et amecha. Or in Yiddish, there's a tradition that they say, nisht eins, like not one, not two, not three, right? Huh? Yeah, nisht zwei, nisht drei, right? Why? Same idea, because there was a case in King David's time. When they misinterpreted the halakha, they didn't realize that it applies always. They thought it only applies in certain circumstances. And they did that and a plague broke out, right? And the Talmud says it came from that. We don't do that because we don't highlight people. We don't overexpose people. We don't do that. We're all group, we're all connected. And we don't sort of separately highlight people. That's why we don't count people. There's another very interesting halakha. It's more related to men, but it's just interesting. That when we have the reading of the Torah in shul, you know how it works. For example, on a Shabbat, When you read the Torah, you call up seven people. That's an aliyah, it's called, right? You go up, you call up, right? You're not supposed to call up a father and a son one after another. You're not supposed to call up two brothers one after another. Why? Because it creates, again, a focus. You know, you don't want someone sitting in the shul, oh, who's this big Yichus family over here that are getting all the call-ups today? You know what I'm saying? Like, right? You don't want to facilitate that. Therefore, we don't do that. It's like a whole thing. You break it up, you stagger it. It shouldn't be so obvious, right? This, by the way, it's a very relevant halakha, by the way. It creates a lot of problems, this halakha, when you have a simcha, right? So, you know, a groom's got a call-up, and, you know, the father or the groom himself comes to the rabbi and says, okay, you know, I need six call-ups this Shabbos for the simcha. You look at it and they're like, they're all brothers or something. You can't do that, right? You gotta work it out. And sometimes it's hard to work it out. Like, anyway, that's the concept, right? When there's a brocha, like just like the idea of the field, as the field is growing, you try not to, you know, people looking at your field, there is a very, very big custom, and that a lot of people practice this, that when a woman becomes pregnant, you don't reveal it, only to very, very close people until it's obvious, until like the fifth month or something like that, right? There's a lot of people keep that. You don't tell people. It's a bracha in its vulnerable stages. It needs to take shape. It needs to develop. When it becomes obvious, it becomes obvious, right? For that reason, also, many people won't tell you how many grandchildren they have, right? You know that? Yeah, people ask you how many grandchildren you have. You don't say. Some people won't say a lot, or okay, I know they're all doing well. You're not gonna, okay. Right, but they won't actually tell your number. Because again, you don't want to highlight blessings, right? That's the idea. Okay, so I guess what we've established so far is that Ayin Hara is a real thing. It is in the Talmud, it can have an effect. The question is, so what do we do about it? Like, how do we protect ourselves from Ayin Hara? So I want to share with you a couple of interesting things, but I want to just give a bit of a context and a bit of a background. In Jewish practice, there are two things that we do that bring blessing. One is we work on ourselves, we become better people, we keep mitzvot, we put in the hard work to grow as a human being and to grow as a Jew. Then there are other things called zgulot. Zgulot means like an omen for something, right? Which is a real thing. There are certain things that we do which apparently are good symbols and bring blessing. I don't know. For example, I'll give you an example. There's a famous one that I don't know if you've heard of it, that the Shabbos after Pesach, the first Shabbos, if you bake challah, you bake in the shape of a key. It's called Shlissel challah, right? What is that for? It's supposed to be a symbol. It's a zagula. It's a good omen for parnasa, for good livelihood. Even in Rosh Hashanah, we do things. For example, we have simanim. We put apple and honey. We eat things that are symbolic good things, and it draws down blessing, right? With Ayin Hara, there are lots of these things, and I'm going to share some of you with them and discuss them. And some of them are legitimate, and some of them have legitimate sources in the Torah. But I'm going to share some of you with them, but then I want to share the real thing, because segulot have a basis, good omens have a basis, and if they're legitimate, they brought down in the early holy works, then they're good. But the problem is, and this I've seen this of late, that people sort of hop onto these things, as they say, and that almost becomes the whole Judaism, right? And that's not what's meant to be, because we know that in Judaism, one of the most fundamental things is growth, to work on ourselves, a way of life, to develop a way of life that is good, right? Which takes hard work. Segulot are legitimate, but they like delegating the work to something else, right? I mean, I don't have to change. I'll just do I'll wear a red string, or I'll put whatever, that kind of thing, right? So that's it. Not that it's not legitimate, and it maybe has a connection to bringing blessings, but that's not the source of blessing ultimately. Source of protection, the source of blessing comes from developing perspective, developing a way of thinking, a way of living. So let me share with you some of the segulot, but then I want to share with you some of the ways of living that are brought down in the Talmud and other places that have to do with protecting us from Ayin Hara. Okay. So, in the Talmud, there's all kinds of things. The Talmud says if someone feels they've been protected from Ayin Hara, I don't understand this one, I don't exactly what it means, but they to put your thumb in your hand and to say something. And I've never seen that practice, so I'm not sure what that is. There's another one that some people do things that they make something, you hang up something in the shape of a fish. Why the fish? Interesting, on Rosh Hashanah, we also have this idea of eating a fish. on the head of a fish, or fish generally, because we know that fish are protected from ayin hara. Why? You know, because there's always a protection of fish. You know that fish sleep with their eyes open. Did you know that? Yeah? So that's an amazing, that means also a symbol of like they're always on watch. It's always the protection. And also they're covered. And everything that's covered is not susceptible to an ayin hara. And therefore, a fish is always connected. That's why we eat fish on Rosh Hashanah night, actually, as a protection. And then some people always, they have a thing on the shape of a fish to ward off the evil eye. There's another one that people use, salt. Now, I know this very well. Maybe I'll share this with you before. And I'll share with you an interesting thing, which will come clear later. My parents, of blessed memory, my father was never worried about ayin hara, and my mother was. Part of it had to do with my mother came from a very small shtetl, my father came from a very big city. I don't know, for some reason, people came from small shtetl, had this thing about ayin hara, and they were always very, they were very, very scared of it, right? So I remember that when I got dressed up for my bar mitzvah, I had a new suit and everything, I was all dressed up and about to go to the reception, my mother called me over and poured salt in my pocket. Right? Yeah, why? She was worried. Ayin hara, like, you know, I'm going to be the center of attention for the night. But now there's such a thing because we know that, I think I've shared this to you before, salt does have the concept of protection. We do know that's one of the reasons we dip challah in salt. The reason for that is because salt, there's many reasons Kabbalistically, but salt is something that lasts. It doesn't go off. So it's very permanent. It's very strong. And it was also used before refrigeration. It was used for preservative. It was used to hold things fresh, right? So salt is, my father was used to laugh at these things. It was very levitic. But you know, salt in the pockets of that, okay? So salt is a thing also. Another one is the chamsa. Now this is interesting. This is a bit of a controversial one because some people say it's got very non-Jewish origins. Although, interestingly enough, the Ben Ish Chai, let me just tell you who he was. The Ben Ish Chai was a great Kabbalist and a very, very big Sephardic leader of Baghdad in Iraq. He passed away in 1902, not that long ago, relatively speaking, right? He was an undisputed leader. He was a leader of thousands and thousands of Jews. There was a huge community. At the very beginning of the 20th century, there was a huge community in Iraq in general and in Baghdad particularly. And he was the Rav, he was the undisputed leader of that community. And he writes various books, and he's got one book called the Ben Ish Chai, and that's why he's known as the Ben Ish Chai. His name is Yosef Chaim. And he says that there are some people who have accustomed to say the word Chamsa for Ayin Hara, which means five. Chamsa comes from the word Chamesh, right? Five, right? In Arabic. To ward off the evil eye, and he says, and some people wear a little hand, or five fingers with a letter hey. So apparently he didn't consider it a problem. There are those that write that it is a problem. It's got very non-Jewish, perhaps very like negatively non-Jewish sources, but he didn't seem to think it was a problem. He seemed to think it was okay. Which brings us to the final segula, which people always often ask me about, and that is the red string, right? What's that? Yeah, the red string. Yeah. Now, is there a source for the custom and is it permissible? So we find an unbelievable thing. First of all, customs that develop in Jewish tradition often have holiness. There was a great rabbi called, a very famous thing, called the Rashba, right? The Rashba, his name was, I don't know what his name was. It's called the Rashba, it's an acronym or something. And he lived in the 13th century. And he talked about something that we refer to as Minag Nashim Skenot, which means customs that are passed down from mother to daughter. They're called the Minhag, the customs of the older women. Right? These are customs that you won't find in the sources. These are customs that you won't find in Halakha necessarily. But they're customs that women were passed on. One woman heard from her mother, heard from her mother. We don't know where it started, but he said, one should be very careful not to laugh at the minhag nashim skenot, at these minhagim that were passed down mother to daughter, because if they were passed down and became a custom, he says there's like a collective divine spirit in the Jewish nation, and he says never make light of their ways and their customs, because they certainly have a source in the high and holy places, even if the rationale is hidden from us. It's a very beautiful description of minhag nashim skenot, right? And there are actually, in fact, very interesting things. There are many customs in Jewish practice that we don't know exactly where they come from, and we don't know exactly what the source is, But exactly that. They were passed down from mother to daughter. That's what it is. Now, what's interesting is that maybe the red string is one of these customs, but these are very early Talmudic source, right? In the times of the Talmud, when I say the Talmud, I mean the Gemara and the Talmud, right? But during that time, there were other things written also from great sages, and one of them is known as the Tosefta. The Tosefta is a Talmudic, is a halachic literature from Talmudic times, but it's not stuff that made it into the actual Talmud. There it says that the red string is prohibited. Why? We'll see if we accept that or not, right? Why? Because in the Talmud there's this concept that we're not allowed to do things that are darkei ha-emori, the Emorite practices, right? Because the Emorites were pagan worshippers, and there were certain practices that came from them, and we are warned against not doing things that are Emorite practices. And the Tosefta says that the red string is just it's an Emorite custom, and we should stay away from it. However, interesting enough, the Rabbi Yosef Karo, the great author of the Shulchan Aruch, 16th century rabbi in Tzfat, writes, he says that no, anything that's in the Tosefta that did not make it into the Talmud itself is not binding. It's not binding, and we don't have to listen to it necessarily, right? And therefore he says we don't have to accept that prohibition, and it could be... Now, is there other sources? So what was it accepted? So there's a lot of stuff in this. I don't want to do this briefly. I'll just tell you something interesting. There's a letter to a great rabbi in Jerusalem. This is early 20th century stuff. And it came from Poland. And it comes from a rabbi called Rabbi Avraham Chaim. And he was the son of a great Hasidic rebbe known as the Alexander Rebbe. Alexander is not such a big Hasidic sect today, but it was very big in Poland. Ah, your father was Alexander Chusid? There we are. So they have a group. Yeah, Alexander. Yeah. I think it also came from the town they lived in. I don't know. But anyway, Alexander Chassidim. So this was a son of his. At that time, this person wasn't Alexander Rebbe. He was the son of Alexander Rebbe. And I think he was writing about his wife. It doesn't say clearly in the letter, but he writes to this very great rabbi in Israel. And he says, I'll quote it for you. He says, it's been 12 years since the wedding and she has not become pregnant. But now, thank God, she is. I think he's talking about his wife. Please pray for mercy for her at the holy sites in Israel. There were a lot of holy sites. That she should reach full term easily without any complications, God forbid. And that she should give birth to a living and healthy child. So he's asking for him to go and pray in Israel, the beautiful sites. The grave of Rachel, I don't know, the grave of the patriarchs, different places, right? Arizal, whatever, different places. Now he says, if I may request a favor. Being that we know from our holy uncle, the Yismach Moshe, who was a very famous Hasidic rebel, so blessed memory, that for such a protection, one measures, and he's talking about a red string, one takes red wool or red string, and you measure it around the tomb of our mother Rachel. I request that you go there and measure out the tomb and send me the strings as a protection that she should complete her pregnancy. Amazing letter. In other words, there was obviously a legitimate custom. These were very holy people and they would never do anything that's wrong. But the custom wasn't just about a red string. It was particularly about taking a string that's red and putting it around the kever, the tomb of kever Rachel. And then they would use that string, right? Now there's a whole thing about why it's what it is, and if it's red, red is gevura. It could be good gevura, especially once it's gone around the grave of Rachel. And gevura is strength, and therefore it's able to protect a person against things that might interfere. And all these kind of things. So that's an interesting thing. So yes, it's legitimate. Yes.
Just going back to the salt for a minute and yeah. The customs passed down. My late mother always, whenever someone moved into a new home,
yes,
salt
yes.
would bring red.
Yes, 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 that's, yes, 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 yes. We do that.
Is it the same?
Yeah, absolutely.
Salt, bread, and can.
Salt, bread,
and can.
We do. I mean, there's different ways of doing the custom. We bring in salt, salt and bread, and a Jewish book, like something. The candle could be also. Yeah, yeah.
But if you spill the salt, you've got the
spoiler. I think that's actually a non-Jewish custom. Yeah, yeah. So obviously, when we say that you should always respect you always have to examine certain customs. Are they really customs that have been handed down from mother to daughter, or they just came from some secular society? But that's written in many places. Yeah, sure. Before you come in, you bring bread, salt. Bread is panasa. Salt is, yeah. Anyway, yes. Sure, of course.
Curses.
You mean someone curses you, you mean?
If someone curses your future generations or something.
Yes, that's interesting. So we do and we don't. It's similar to the Ayin Hara.
Isn't that an Ahara?
Yes, like an Ayin Hara. It's the same sort of thing. Like a person gets upset with you. So, I mean, this is what we've established, right? There somehow is a power of a person to inflict upon another person something that's the opposite of blessing. We obviously... Now, the question is what you do about it, right? Correct. There's a power of speech, the power of thought, the power of perspective, these things. So it means ayin hara. You look at a person negatively, it can have an effect. Okay. Now, I've just given you things people protect themselves from the salt, all these kind of things. Okay. They are skulot, they're good omens, they all have some legitimacy, the salt, the chamsa even, according to the Ben Ish Chai, the red string, and so on. The fish, all that. However, as I said, like, that's not, just to do these things is actually not what Judaism wants from us, right? You can do them too, but it's not really what's expected of us. What's expected of us is to look at our way of life and to see what the way we're behaving, is that a good way of behaving, and is that something that will ward off negativity, right? So I want to share with you a bunch of them, like about six, I think, if it is. But certain things that we need to explore and look at that we know are not just gulot, not just good omens, but actually mitzvot, or they are ways of life that will certainly bring blessing and certainly ward off negative, negative things. Okay. The first is, we have a verse in the Torah, and this is difficult, particularly in the context of today's society, which is a very society about flashiness and proving it and image and social media and all that kind of stuff, right? Which is all can be used for good sometimes, but also is used often in ways that are completely the antithesis to the values of Judaism. And it comes from this concept of, there's a pasuk, there's a verse in the Torah, Hatznei lechet im Hashem Elokecha. It says, walk, it's got two translations, modestly or humbly, and they're connected actually, in the ways of God. Now, it's the idea of what we call tzniut. I'm not talking about tzniut in dress, it includes that, of course, but it's not. It's in everything, in behavior, in speech, in just the way we live, right? And the way we live, the Jewish value is to live humbly. It doesn't mean that we can't have nice things. It doesn't mean that we can't live comfortably. That's not what it means. But it means in a way that we don't flaunt. We don't make a big thing out of it. We don't publicize stuff. We just are humble. Now, part of that is, there's a couple of things which are connected to that, right? In other words, we live more privately. I mean, obviously, sometimes people overemphasize privacy and you can never get anything out of them. Like, there's this whole concept, should people, like, this is an interesting one, like about charity, right? You know, even that, like, in Jewish sources, we have the value of giving tzedakah, giving charity in a more private way, sort of in a hidden way, right? Although it's not so simple there, because we also have the same Rashba that I quoted before, the 13th century sage. He said, actually, when it comes to doing mitzvot, sometimes it is important to publicize it, right? Because it inspires others. Say someone gives tzedakah and he gives a lot of money, whatever, or a lot of help, or a lot of assistance, and it's public, then it actually helps other people. Okay, so one has to learn how to balance that. But generally speaking, there's this idea of, I don't need everything publicized, I don't need to publicize everything in my life. You know, there's certain people, like you meet them and within 5 minutes, you know, the entire life history from when they were born, all their traumas and all the successes and everything, you know, it doesn't only take, that's not a Jewish thing, that. Edel, it's called in Yiddish edel. Edel means to be a refined person, to be an understated person, not to, you know. And it's part of living what I always call, and I always share with you, this idea of living, there's two ways of living, outside in and inside out. Right, outside in means that our entire life is based on the perspective of other people and how people look at us and the image we have and so on. That normally brings to overexposure, over flaunting, over just being public and over being out there and louder than everyone else and more, making sure everyone understands how successful we are and so on and so forth. And all living inside out, we live based on our values. That becomes our identity. That becomes who we are. And that's the most important thing. And it's the goal is not for everyone to know everything. It doesn't need to be that like that. And it's like living bitzniut. Now, it's so important because, first of all, it shows a more authentic type of life. It also breeds gratitude. The idea of not always publicizing, not always talking about the greatness that we have and the success that we have and so on and so forth, means also we don't take it for granted. We actually are thankful. We're not entitled. God doesn't owe us anything. And we, every day in our prayers, we thank God for all the blessings that we have. And so we should, the power of gratitude. And one of the ways to show gratitude is that we don't take it for granted and we're humble about it, right? We know where it comes from. We understand that all our blessings come from God. Another thing of living that way also shows sensitivity to other people. Often when we publicize our strength or our successes, you know, there are always people around that maybe don't have those successes, that people that are struggling, whether it's with their children or with other things or with their finances or just generally their emotions, their mental health. And sensitivity to others is part of living in a way of tzniut and part of living in a way of humility and modesty and so on and so forth. Which leads into, of course, the second thing about we know what brings ayin hara. What brings ayin hara is jealousy, essentially, right? And one of the ways to protect ourselves from it is to work on our own midah of jealousy, to make sure that we are not living full of jealousy, which is sometimes a hard thing. Now, why is jealousy so important? Why is it in the Ten Commandments? Interestingly enough, right? I mean, there are other things we're not supposed to feel, we're not supposed to take revenge, a lot of things we're not allowed to do, but jealousy is particularly important, not to be jealous. Why? Because jealousy actually, and I think we've discussed this once before, that jealousy goes to the heart of our belief in God. If we really believe that everything comes from Hashem, and we really believe in Hashkacha Pratit, that everything is supervised by God and there's divine providence and so on, then we believe that what I have today is what I'm meant to have. And because I don't have what someone else has, I wasn't meant to have it. And I don't need it today. Now, it could be something that I do really need tomorrow. So I pray for it. That's between me and Hashem. But I'm not jealous of others. First of all, we know that God has a lot of money, so He can provide for me and for the other person. Right? In other words, when we're jealous, it's also another problem. When we're jealous, it's because we define ourselves by our physical success a lot of times, right? And therefore, we define ourselves by that, and therefore, jealousy sometimes, not only that we want to have something, is we don't want the other person to have it. We want to have better than others, right? That's part of jealousy. And again, that's like the opposite of we're not defined by what we have, we're defined by who we are. And the things we have is what we're meant to have. God has given us each in the morning, when we wake up in the morning, we have what we're meant to have, and those are the resources that God has given us to fulfill our purpose today. Tomorrow might be different, right? So that's easy to talk about then, easy to say that, but it is hard to implement sometimes, right? Because you know, we do have these thoughts like, why is it so difficult for me today, and why is that person finding it so easy? That's a hard thing, right? So it goes to the heart of our emunah, and it's certainly that is not just an omen; it's hard work, but it's hard work that creates a lot of blessing when we really have that perspective of believing that God is the provider of everything, and He gives us what we meant to have, and what we have is what we meant to have, and so on. It certainly brings a tremendous amount of bracha, and it certainly is one of the protections of ayin hara. Yeah.
What if it's not about material wealth, it's about peace of mind and happiness, knowing that your children are happy, even if you've done your best?
Yeah, so that needs like 3 hours to talk about. But that's a good question.
But I think it's going to be enough 3 hours.
Yeah, probably not. So that's hard. Look, it is very hard, but we know that ultimately, look, you know, when we talk about this, let me answer this way very quickly. When we talk about these things, we give an answer. There's philosophies around these ideas. The problem with saying them quickly is because then people just think, are you mad? Like, I can never get there, right? But in Judaism, we do that. We talk about the ideal, the goal. And our job is not to reach the goal. Our job is to take one step towards the goal, right? So everyone goes through tests, and some people go through bigger tests than others. And yes, it all goes under the category of talking about bitachon, really. And bitachon really is that it's going to be okay, and God has given me a test, and He only asks me things that I can handle, and which sometimes we say, maybe I can't handle it, can you give it to someone else, or not give it to anyone else, or whatever. You know, like that Jew said, you know, maybe it can be the chosen nation, maybe someone else can be chosen for a while, right? But we don't think like that. And therefore, to actually develop the joy that even though we have a struggle of peace of mind, but to know it's all coming from Hashem, we are in Hashem's hands, and it's going to be okay. Is that easy? No, that's a very hard perspective. Can we reach it? No, but we can try and take steps towards it. And that's difficult. That's difficult. It takes a lot of learning and thinking. And yeah. Although I will say, when it comes to jealousy, there is good jealousy. I've spoken about this before. There is good jealousy when we are jealous more in an aspirational sense, and it's got to do with spirituality. Like when we see someone, you know, the Talmud says that competition and jealousy among scholars increases wisdom. Like if I see someone that's really doing well, I can be jealous of it in the sense, not that I don't want him to succeed, but I aspire to be like that. That's okay. Because Judaism believes that in the spiritual growth, that's up to us. God physically gives us, and emotionally, and sort of what we need in terms of health, physical stuff, He gives us what we need, but He wants us to grow in our spiritual, and therefore that's okay to see someone who's doing better spiritually and say, I want to be like that. That's good jealousy. Okay, so there's good jealousy. All right. Now, we have a principle in Judaism. I'm going to come to the third thing now. That whatever is true in the negative is more true in the positive. So therefore, if ayin hara, if there's a concept of ayin hara, which means the concept that a person can have an evil eye. An evil eye means that the negative perspective on someone else can cause damage. We must believe that if the opposite is true in the spiritual sense, it can cause greater blessing. What do I mean? While we have this idea called ayin hara, we actually in Jewish writings have the concept of ayin tova. To train ourselves to look at another person with a good eye. What does that mean? It means to look at someone, first of all, never to look at someone as inferior. Look at each person as their soul, as who they are. It also means to genuinely know how to celebrate the celebration of others. It's not always so easy. You know that sometimes it's easier to empathize and to join someone else in their sorrow than joining him in their joy, right? You don't have to put up your hand if you've experienced this, right? But have you ever been invited to a simcha and you say, oh, what a pain in the neck, another night, I've got to go, right? Unless it's someone very close to you, right? But you wouldn't say that if a person was going through a real terrible time, you say, I have to go, it's such a sad thing, it's a tragedy, right? Sometimes harder to actually really be happy for someone else, particularly if you don't have that same happiness, right? I know a person who doesn't live in Sydney anymore, and I'm not going to say the name, obviously. We didn't have children for many, many, many years, and it really didn't seem that it was going very well. And I've never seen a person like this, who every time she heard someone had a baby, which, by the way, is very difficult for people who suffer infertility, but this person, she was genuinely happy. I mean, it was like unbelievable. Oh, so nice, so beautiful. And I always thought, like, how do you do this? Like, it's, you know, many of you might know people, I'm sure, that have suffered infertility. Infertility is a terrible, terrible challenge. And it brings tremendous pain and tremendous unhappiness. And it is difficult to have this ayin tova. And this person was there, and out of the blue, eventually the blessing came, not from treatment, not from anything. She just became pregnant. She had a daughter, and a few years later had a son. She has two beautiful children today. Amazing. And I'm convinced that it just happened eventually because of ayin tova. Like, I mean, I'm not convinced. I don't know God. If I would be convinced, I know God. But just amazing, right? Just having that, looking at another person, being sensitive to the needs of the other person, celebrating another person's simcha, all that kind of stuff, that's an ayin tova. And I'm sure that if ayin hara is a thing, ayin tova must be even a bigger thing. And therefore, ayin tova, it's a good thing. Not only just to be jealous, but actually to be happy for the other person. It's one thing not to be jealous. Okay, he's got what he got. That's fine. I'm not jealous of it. That's fine. I have what I have. More than that, it's actually ayin tova to be actually really happy for the person. Someone gets a position. Someone gets a blessing. Someone, whatever. To be really, really happy for that person. And also just to be really, really sensitive to that person. And to think about other people the whole time, what they need. I'll tell you a beautiful, beautiful story. I'm sure I've told it before, but it's a Pesach story, but it's unbelievable. After the war, you know, Jews went back a lot of times to the place that they lived, and the Romanian Jews, a lot of them came back. It was tough, and there were two Hasidic Rebbes in Romania. One was called the Skulena Rebbe, and one was called the Vizhinitsa Rebbe. Different towns, right? They were both great tzaddikim, great righteous people. The Skulena Rebbe was well known for his Avat Yisrael, just for care and knowing. Later, his son became the Rebbe, there's a bar park now, it's his grandson that's the Rebbe. Also, they're very into helping people. And So the Sgalon Rebbe, it was before Pesach, and there was no Pesach, there was nothing to buy, it was just not available anything. And he drove himself crazy to find a bit of wheat, and you know, and anti-Semitism was after the war, but anti-Semitism was alive and well, it wasn't easy. And he found wheat, and he found flour, and he was able to bake matzahs before Pesach. So he let known in the community he's baking matzahs, but it's only for the mitzvah for the first night, it's not going to be Pesach, that's all the Pesach. And he can give every family only two matzahs. That's it, only two matzahs. One for each night of the Seder. Okay. A couple of days before Pesach, there's a knock at the door. It's the Vizhnitsa Rebbe's son. Vizhnitsa Rebbe's son, my father, to ask me to come and ask you and tell you that it's very, very, very important that he is given four matzahs, not two. That's clever. I was shocked. I mean, why is one person better than the other? Like, you know. And he was really a bit surprised, but it's the vision of the Rebbe. He said, but I said only two. He says, no, my father says he has to have four. Has to have four. And he said, okay, the vision of the Rebbe said, so I'll give four. And he gave him four. An hour before Pesach, there's a knock at the door at the Sgalon Rebbe's house. He opens the door, it's the vision of the Rebbe's son there. He said, well, now what? He says, my father wants to know if you have matzahs for Pesach. He says, actually don't. What happened was, the Sgalon Rebbe said he's going to give out everyone two, he's going to give everyone two matzahs, right? The Vizhnitsa Rebbe knew that that means he's going to give out till the last matzah is gone, he's not going to keep any for himself. So he sent his son to ask for four matzahs, and then he sent back the two just before Pesach. The greatness of both these people is how they thought of other people. The Sgalon Rebbe did it, that he was prepared. He said, well, why is that person's matzah more important than mine? So the last person asked for matzahs, says, well, you need matzahs, I'll give them matzahs. I won't be left with any. So who said he's more important than me? And it's the foresight of the Vizhnitsa Rebbe that knew he was going to do that, and therefore sent back two matzahs before Pesach. It's a training of the mind. We're not on that level, but I'm saying it's a training of the mind. Finally, before I go to, not finally, but almost finally, is the idea of unity. Unity brings blessing and wards off any negativity. Why is that so important? Because one of the ideas, I'm going to tell you an idea that I heard from my grandfather once. One of the ideas of Ayin Hara is because the person becomes highlighted. It's not to be good. It's not good to be highlighted, right? I'll just explain that. When we're together, we're less highlighted. So I'll tell you very quickly because time's running out. My grandfather, Rabbi Eloy, he explained this. He told me this once. He says, there's a story in Tanakh. There was a prophet called Elisha. And Elisha would travel and he would stay at a person's house. There was a woman who made for him a special room with a chair and a bed and a whole thing. And after a while, he told his attendant that he should travel with, can you call that woman of the house, call that lady? Maybe she needs something. I'd like to do something for her. All right? She calls her and she says, you know, you've always given me this house free of charge whenever I travel. There's a room special for me. What can I do for you? Maybe I can talk to the king for you. And so that's what he said. Maybe I can put in a good word to the king for you. And she answered, "Betoch ami anochi yoshevet." I sit among my nation. Very funny dialogue. And then afterwards, it was Elisha heard that she doesn't have any children, so he prayed for her and she had a son. Okay. So I'll story with that son later on. He became Yonah the prophet. But what was that dialogue? He said, "Can I maybe put in a good word to the king for you?" And she said, "No. I sit among my nation." So he told me this idea. He said that it was actually not the king. It was the King of Kings. He was talking about God. Because that day was Rosh Hashanah when he called her. He was traveling. He was staying there for Rosh Hashanah. And he called them, talked about this on Rosh Hashanah. And he said, do you want me to put in a good word for you? To Hashem. Do you want me to pray for you? And she said, no. Why? Because I sit among my nation. She says, I don't want to be highlighted. I don't want God... You should pray for me. And God should say, who are you praying for? Oh, this lady. Let's have a look. Let's examine what she really, how good she'd be in the last year, right? But tochami anachi yeshevet. I just want to go with everyone else. I'm equal to everyone else. Like this, it's easier to, I want God to look at us collectively and to bless us all together, right? So you tell me this idea, that it's not good to be highlighted. That's why unity is such an important thing. And it says, we know that. Unity, the Mishnah says clearly, unity, shalom, peace, unity brings blessing. Look, we can't change the whole nation, but we could change our own life. We can be more united with others. We can overlook flaws. We can overlook faribles. We can overlook things that people have done to us. We can be more united. Unity certainly brings blessing. Another quickly, I'm going to do this quickly, and then the last point is probably the most important. But the next thing is the power of speech. We know the power of speech is very, very powerful, which is why we have this phrase, Kenan Hara. We take that. Like, if we do need to share something, or we do need to talk about something nice that happened, we preface it. We say, Bli Ayin Hara, Kenan Hara, whatever language you want to say it in, because speech does have a power, and when you pray that it shouldn't affect you, it has a force. Number six is that there's also things that there are mitzvot. We know that are directly, all mitzvot bring blessings, but there are mitzvot that are directly connected with protection. I'll just tell you two. One of them, of course, is having a kosher mezuzah up on the doors, and the other one is tzedakah. Charity certainly gives a tremendous blessing. You know, you asked before, because it's been asked to me before about someone, this question you asked before about how about if someone says something not nice to me or cursed me, whatever, like, you know, that kind of thing. So I always talk about personally, you have kosher mezuzahs on your door, and if you're really worried about it, just go give some tzedakah and forget about it. Like, you know, because tzedakah brings blessing. Which leads me to my final point, and I'll finish with this, and that is, and maybe it's the most important thing. All these things are important, very, very important. But although it is a real thing, and although we have even halachot, as I said before, about calling up to the Torah and so on, that we do because of this, but really, the Talmud says something very, very powerful. It's not directly in context of the Ayin Hara, it's in context with another practice that could be damaging. And it's about eating things in pairs, not eating things in zugot. It's a whole thing. I'm not going to go into it now. But there's a long couple of pages in the Talmud that discusses it. And at the end, the Talmud makes the following statement. I'll say it in Aramaic and then I'll translate. It says, Man de kapid kapitinan le, uman de lo kapid lo kapitinan le, which means, at the end of the day, if you worry about it, then it can affect you. If you don't worry about it, it doesn't affect you. In other words, the most important protection is not to think about it. Right? In other words, positive thinking. Think only good. Think it's going to be okay. Think it's fine. I think that's the difference between the... my mother used to worry about it, so she'd do the salt and everything like that. My father says, no, it's all going to be good. Just don't worry about it. Be what they call masiyach das. Be just take your mind off it and just think positively. And that goes into the whole idea of bitachon. The really most important thing is to know that Hashem is in charge. He's taking care of us and not to... Oh yeah, of course you have to do the halachot and the protections that are needed. But other than that, the real Jewish way is not to think about it. Of course, to try to live more privately, to try to live more refined, to have a good eye, to give tzedakah, mezuzah. All these things are very important. Do the practices that we don't do and so on. But at the end of the day, the most powerful thing is to have positive thinking, emunah, bitachon, and not to worry about it. And we don't worry about it, it doesn't affect you. We should all have a life only a blessing. Again, remind, I'll be away next week. In 2 weeks' time, we start the series, personal growth series of learning different things from Viktor Frankl. And we'll see you then. Thank you.